Welcome to the official SBGN podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely.
Because we don't know at the time of podcast recording, of interview, exactly in what order individual podcasts will be presented to the audience at home, it's difficult for me to say whether or not you've already made the acquaintance of the two persons whom we're going to be interviewing today. One, and the principal respondent to the questions that will be posed, is Professor Amit Asa. Professor Asa works in Israel, where he's from, and is at the moment employed as the chair of the Institute for Pediatric Gastroenterology at Kaplan Medical Center in Rehovot, and is a full professor of pediatrics at the Hebrew University. His interviewer is Vangelis Chomouris. Vangelis is a senior fellow in hepatology, pediatric hepatology, at King's College Hospital in the liver unit there. He has, in order to illustrate some of the principles on which the treatment of ulcerative colitis is based and how choices are made among treatments, has prepared three clinical vignettes. Interesting patients, complicated patients, difficult patients, and he's going to present those vignettes to the professor so that we can obtain your insights, sir, into how those patients might be treated and what factors you are weighing as you make your treatment choices. With that, I'm going to step back, and Vangelis, it's over to you.
Thank you very much for your introduction. It's an honor to be part of this podcast with Amit today, who not only is the author of these important guidelines, but is also very consistently supportive of young SBGN and early career colleagues. So we are trying to break down the guidelines through real-world case discussions, covering drug sequencing, therapeutic drug monitoring, and challenges in managing acute severe colitis. But before we dive in, Amit, please allow me to provide a very brief introduction to the topic. Pediatric IBD and subsequently ulcerative colitis presents unique challenges compared to the adult states. Pediatric ulcerative colitis in particular tends to be more extensive and severe, requiring tailored treatment approach. Despite advances in the management of ambulatory pediatric ulcerative colitis, challenges remain as many patients are refractory to therapy and some require colectomy. The last SBGN ECHO guidelines were published in 2018. Since then, there have been significant advances in our understanding of disease monitoring and drug optimization and emerging therapies. And that's why these updated guidelines were completely essential. Amit, can you start by telling us why an update to the guidelines was necessary and what were the main factors driving these changes?
Thank you, Alex and Vangelis. I am delighted to be here. As you said, Vangelis, since 2018, we have gained a better understanding of optimizing therapy using new modalities such as intestinal ultrasound and therapeutic drug monitorings. And we are utilizing more and more newer treatments, though not approved for children yet. We give them off-label, and we have more opportunities than we had before.
Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to talking about cases. So let's dive into our first case. We have a 12-year-old patient with moderate left-side ulcerative colitis who has been on mesalazine but is showing signs of disease activity, has 5 loose stools per day, let's say, has minor bleeding, and the well-known Pukai score of 25. First, how will we assess disease activity? Is Pukai and fecal calprotectin still the suitable tools? And if the clinician decided to escalate treatment, the question is, what is the optimal sequencing of the drugs?
So first of all, about clinical indices in ulcerative colitis, it is different from Crohn's disease, in which clinical indices are not very helpful. In ulcerative colitis, there is a very good correlation between PUCAI as a clinical index and mucosal inflammatory activity. I would say that the use of fecal calprotectin when there is a bloody diarrhea is quite redundant, as in blood you can find anyway a high rate of fecal calprotectin. So when there is rectal bleeding, it is redundant. When there isn't, fecal calprotectin in ulcerative colitis is very helpful. I would also use, in this case, if it is available, intestinal ultrasound. So it is gaining more and more evidence to use this tool even bedside in mild to moderate, and of course in severe cases. And it is complementary to the clinical index and the fecal calprotectin if performed. And you can gain more information by performing the ultrasound and visualize the inflammatory activity.
Right. And if the clinician decided to escalate treatment, the question is, what is the optimal sequencing of the drugs?
Okay, so before we do that, in such a circumstance, it is very important to rule out other reasons of exacerbation, especially infectious reasons such as Clostridium difficile. But after this is done, 5-ASA is a very important drug to fight on. The next steps involve immune modulation. So optimizing non-immune modulation or suppression treatment is essential. So first of all, I would increase the dose of 5-ASA, of oral 5-ASA, up to 100 milligrams per kilogram. Then I would add rectal 5-ASA, usually 1 gram, and this combination therapy was shown to be more effective than mono oral therapy. Then there are a couple of treatment that we can use that are, again, do not involve the immune system. One is oral curcumin or turmeric, and it can use in a combination with multi-strain probiotics. And there are a couple of studies, good studies, including RCTs from adults and pediatric population, showing that adding curcumin to the treatment as an add-on to 5-ASA may assist treatment. Another option is to use a natural therapy called Indigo Naturalis or Qing Dai, which is a Chinese herb. Most of the studies, and there are two RCTs in adults and one prospective study in the pediatric population, showing that 8-week therapy with Indigo Naturalis as an induction agent without stopping 5-ASA can actually bring the patient back into remission. When all these strategies do not work, then another possibility before immune modulation is using corticosteroids with lower systemic effects, such as beclomethasone dipropionate, BDP, or budesonide MMX for 8 weeks to try to restore remission and still keep the patients on combination of 5-ASA, curcumin, probiotics, and avoid immune modulation. And if all of this does not work, then the next step, if still the disease is with mild to moderate activity, is to move forward to azathioprine and to add it as an addition to 5-ASA. 5-ASA is a very safe drug, so I would just keep it on board with azathioprine when adding azathioprine to the treatment.
All right, so that is a scenario that the child is controlled well with a first and second line choices. But what if the disease is not well controlled on these line treatments and we want to go a step further, as we have seen in pediatrics quite a lot?
So any step further from this point requires a re-evaluation. And endoscopic evaluation is always recommended before these major therapeutic changes. And also to repeat the fecal sample analysis for C. diff infection, because sometimes it is a surprising finding. So you send a fecal sample again and again, and suddenly you get a positive result. So we should not send only once fecal sample for C. diff, but when there is a prolongation of inflammatory activity, it is advised to send it again and again, and to verify that this is not involved in the inflammatory process. So the first biologic I would use after failure of either corticosteroids or an immunomodulator should be infliximab. Still, infliximab is the most effective biologic drug that we have. And there are studies showing that we should actually start higher. So start with 10 milligrams per kilogram and shorter intervals, even in ambulatory patients. Another option, and especially when it will be approved for children, and probably it's going to happen in the next year, is vedolizumab when the disease is moderate. So for severe disease, I would use the most effective drug, which is infliximab. For moderate disease, we can use vedolizumab as the first choice, especially when it will be approved. I must say that infliximab should be optimized using TDM, either reactive if there is no full response, even during induction, but especially at the end of induction, just to see that the patient is receiving the right dose. And regularly, I would say once a year when in remission, and reactively when there is some activity, let's say high calprotectin, for example. And we should aim for higher trough concentration. So it was shown consistently that a higher trough concentration is needed to achieve mucosal healing, which is part of our targets in treatment. And with infliximab, more than 8 micrograms per milliliter are required to achieve this goal. If infliximab is not working with an adequate trough concentration, then the next step should be either vedolizumab or anti-IL-23 or IL-12-23, such as ustekinumab or the newer anti-P19 drugs, such as risankizumab, guselkumab, and mirikizumab. And perhaps our last resort in these cases are the newer anti-JAK medications, which are not termed biologic treatment, but small molecules. And this should be the last line. These medications are very effective, more effective than the other options that I mentioned in between anti-TNF and JAKs. But we may bear in mind that there is a deeper immune suppression under anti-JAKs, and this should be reserved for the non-responding patients as the last line.
All right, so just to clarify about the timing of biologics. So we are aiming to minimize steroid exposure. How early we need to start biologics? Is it earlier than we used to do as pediatricians, or we need to go a step back?
So again, I would not give up on 5-ASA very quickly. So what I do, and this is supported by the guidelines, is that you may want to use one course of corticosteroids and then give another chance for 5-ASA if the disease is still mild to moderate before you move on to biologics. But when you move on to biologics, and it is very important to reduce corticosteroid exposure, so to keep short courses of steroids, then I would switch quite quickly to infliximab. And again, after a full optimization of a drug, then if there is no response, the next switch should be quite quick. And we should not leave patients with severe symptoms and no response.
That makes a lot of sense. Our second case involves a 14-year-old patient with ulcerative colitis who has been on infliximab but develops an acute severe flare. So the team is considering dose escalation but is not sure whether the patient is underdosed or developing treatment failure. So this is where therapeutic drug monitoring comes in. Can you explain the role of therapeutic drug monitoring in these cases?
So TDM is readily available in most centers in Europe. I think that it has changed our practice in a major way. So we are not blind anymore. We can direct our treatment according to trough concentrations. And the most prevalent mechanism of anti-TNF loss of response is pharmacokinetic failure. So we don't give enough drug. And as the clearance is relatively high in ulcerative colitis and it's higher in children than in adults, then not being blind and look at the trough concentration and optimize treatment based on the trough concentration that we see is so important that we can, and it was shown in the literature, that you can sustain anti-TNF therapy in a much better way than we did before. So the first step when the patient is not responding or losing response to anti-TNF is to measure trough concentration, regardless if it is infliximab or adalimumab, and bring the trough concentration to an adequate level, which should be, I would say, at least 5 micrograms per ml, but preferably more than 8 micrograms per ml. And it is, or it should be individualized. So if you see a response when increasing the drug, but not adequate response, in some patient require higher trough concentration, and sometimes even at a level of 20 micrograms per ml. So this should be individualized per the patient's inflammatory behavior. And I would do it in any patient with some inflammatory activity under anti-TNF. And again, under remission, I would do it proactively every 6 to 12 months.
That's a very clear message. So final case is a 10-year-old child with acute severe colitis that requires hospitalization. And this brings up challenges of supportive care, such as thromboprophylaxis, possible complications, and timing of possible surgery and optimization of nutrition prior to the procedure if needed. Amit, how have the new guidelines changed our approach to acute severe colitis on those cases?
So first of all, when we admit such a patient, we should take care of the support. So the support should include, first of all, to rule out other causes of exacerbation, of course, C. diff, but also if this patient is under any immune suppression, so at least a sigmoidoscopy should be performed with biopsies for CMV. This is not new, but the new thing is that we realized in the last 7-8 years that the rate of VTE, venous thromboembolism, in children is not negligible, and half of the cases involve cerebral sinus vein thrombosis, which is a life-threatening occasion. And this should be prevented for all, and this is the novel recommendation, for all admitted patients with acute severe colitis. Before that, we used a risk stratification model to pick the patients who should receive a VTE thromboprophylaxis, but based on the evidence, the events occurred regardless of risk factors. and even in small children. So the new recommendation is to give thromboprophylaxis to all admitted acute severe colitis patients. Another essential step is at this stage to invite the surgeon and have a surgical consult. If you have an intestinal ultrasound, it was shown to predict response to IV corticosteroids and even other advanced therapies. So to perform an ultrasound at admission and at day three of admission can predict response. Another important thing is when you realize that there is no response to IV steroids, then the dose of corticosteroid should be reduced to the physiological dose of 0.2 milligrams per kilogram. For a full weight child, I would say 15 milligrams, and then gradually reducing the dose to zero. In most cases, in acute severe colitis, the second line after corticosteroid should be infliximab. In exceptional cases, we can use calcineurin inhibitors, but infliximab is safer and it may be used for a longer time for maintenance as well, unlike CNIs, when we use it as a bridge to another therapy such as vedolizumab. And in this case of acute severe colitis, if there is only partial response under infliximab, I would use TDM during induction. So before the second dose of infliximab, you can see if you give enough infliximab. Anyway, it should be given in an accelerated way, so at least 10 milligrams per kilogram and shorter intervals of 0, 1, 3, 4 weeks. But again, use TDM if there is an inadequate response. The novelty of the new guidelines is that in 2018, we had just the option of overlap between calcineurin inhibitors and infliximab. But now we have a real third-line treatment of JAK inhibitors, and especially upadacitinib, that are quite effective in this scenario of refractory acute severe colitis and should be used as the third line. Surprisingly, in some patients, the response is very, very prompt. After 2 to 3 oral doses, you can already see a significant response and sometimes even remission.
This has been an incredibly insightful discussion, and I think you pointed very well the take-home messages. But before we're closing, I would like to ask a matter of concern. It's obvious in the literature that there is a significant gap between the approval of medications for adults and their approval for pediatric patients. So what is the future for children? Why we face those significant delays?
So it is really frustrating. In the adult IBD, there are more or less 2 new drugs released every year. And in our arena, the last approval was 14 years ago, in 2011, with the approval of adalimumab. It means that for the last almost 15 years, no biologic drug or small molecule was approved in children. And this is a significant setback. And one approach that we can use is to require that new adult IBD drugs, when they structure a research plan, they will have to include adolescents, those over 40 kilograms, before granting full adult approval. And with this, it could dramatically reduce delays in access to new therapies. But the current situation in which we wait more than 10 years, and sometimes a lot more, this disadvantages our patients and must be changed by the regulatory authorities.
That's a huge gap, and thank you for calling for urgent intervention. That's a powerful message. Thank you, Amit, for shedding light on these critical issues, and the need for action, I think, is clear, and we hope this conversation sparks further discussion in the medical community. Thank you very much.
And here's where I step in again. Had you forgotten me? I've been here all the time. Really, I've been listening. Were you listening? And I want to thank our interviewee, and I want to thank our interviewer, respectively, Amit and Vangelis. Thanks, and what have you chosen to contribute, you or both of you together, to the Espigan podcast favorite songs playlist to be found on Spotify?
So I would like to refer the audience to an old song from the early 70s by James Taylor, Fire and Rain. Do you know this song?
I've seen sunny times that I thought would never end.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think when I'm a little bit saddened, and there are some reasons for that in the world, I listened to this song because it talks about tragedy, but also about recovery and the strength of the human spirit. So I advise you to listen again to this old song already about 50 years ago, but it's an excellent comfort.
I've seen lonely times when I could not find a friend, but I've always thought that I'd see you again. As long as that's with us, then yeah, there is hope. Thank you.